clouds don't put up over a target. The target was there pretty as a picture. I made the run, let the bomb go. That was my greatest thrill.
Did y'all know that in the event of a national emergency or crisis in this country, the Office of Emergency Planning can put into effect executive orders that will suspend your constitutional bill of rights and take freedom from your ass with the signing of a piece of paper? Executive orders like order number 10,995, which provides for the government takeover of all communications and media. So R&B, hip hop, jazz, rock, and pop, gone. Order number 10,998, the takeover of all food resources and farms. So buds, oolabalas, and amoeficas, gone. 10,999 provides for the takeover of all modes of transportation and control of all major highways, so your Lex Coupes, Beamers, and your Benz, gone. Order number 11,000 provides for the mobilization of all civilians into work brigades under government supervision. Hello, slavery. 11,001, the takeover of all health, education, and welfare functions. 11,002 designates Postmaster General to operate a national registration of all persons in the country. Read Revelations chapter 13. 11,003 provides for the takeover of all airports and aircraft. See, the FAA is trying to do that right now. 11,004 provides for Housing and Finance Authority to relocate communities, build new housing with public funds, designate areas to be abandoned as unsafe, and establish new locations for populations. That just happened with Miller Homes in Trenton, New Jersey, and is happening to Cabrini Green and other projects in Chicago. See, in the event of any national crisis in this country, these executive orders can be put into effect. Let's say if the World Trade Center is bombed, or a federal building in Oklahoma City, a plane blowing up over Long Island, a pipe bomb at the Olympics. These serve to create the panic that is necessary to issue executive order number 11,051, which simultaneously puts all other orders into effect, and niggas are slaves all over again.
We can destroy them with the atomic bomb, we can destroy them and contaminate them.
Since late 2005, the federal government, through a number of agencies, has been engaged in a crackdown on environmental activists who engage in direct action. This crackdown has come to be known as the Green Scare, a throwback to the Red Scare of the 1950s and 60s, in which thousands of innocent people were accused by the federal government of being communists and persecuted for their alleged political beliefs. The most recent manifestation of the Green Scare was during the Republican Convention in Minnesota, during which the police state brutally attacked peaceful demonstrators, preemptively arresting hundreds, brutalizing dozens, and charging seven with felony conspiracy charges, with terrorism enhancements to be added to their sentences. None of those now imprisoned or currently awaiting trial for charges stemming from the Green Scare clampdown have been accused of hurting or attempting to hurt anyone. Most of the charges are related to property damage on corporate or government property, and some of the Green Scare cases do not involve an act of property destruction at all. Simply the conspiracy of thinking about taking such action. With the passage of the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Act, which was easily passed by the House of Representatives in November 2007 with only 6 dissenting votes, and is now in committee in the Senate, conviction for thought crimes will be enshrined into law, and the mere thought of dissent would become an act of terrorism. Current prisoners convicted under the Green Scare include Andy Stepanian, Brianna Waters, Chris McIntosh, Daniel McGowan, Eric McDavid, Jake Conroy, Jeff Lures, Jonathan Paul, Josh Demet, Josh Harper, Lauren Gazzola, Peter Young, Rod Coronado, Trey Arrow, and 6 animal rights activists and an organization, Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty, that are collectively known as the Shack 7. Today, we'll look in depth at one of these cases, the case of Eric McDavid, to find out more about all of these prisoners and the implications of the Green Scare for animal rights and environmental activism nationwide. Check the websites greenscare.org or greenisthenewred.org. First, we go to civil rights attorney Lauren Regan in Eugene, Oregon. We're joined now by civil rights attorney Lauren Regan. Now, Lauren, since 2004, there's been a crackdown on environmental activists known as the Green Scare. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what role terrorism enhancements have played in the trials?
Well, since the Bush administration took office, they have made an unabashed attempt to repress and silence adversaries that they wish to, basically publicly curtail. And the environmental movement, with its growing numbers, was one of the movements that the Bush administration specifically took aim at. And that was largely due to the corporate dollars that were backing them. They had a lot of oil and gas, a lot of timber, a lot of ranching. All of those extractive industries were pouring money into an administration that was listening with both ears quite intently and was doing the bidding of those corporations. And so as a result of that, we saw a number of communities being targeted by FBI surveillance, by grand juries, infiltrators being sent into communities to try to stir up trouble. And ultimately, in 2005, in December of 2005, we saw large-scale indictments and, in fact, the largest roundup of environmental activists by the FBI in a plan that they called Operation Backfire, but which has now been dubbed the Green Scare by most outside of the government. And basically what they were trying to do is demonize mainstream environmentalists. And the way that they did it is a tried and true tactic that's been used over and over again in history, and that is to marginalize the most radical members of that group. And so even though those engaged in property damage and sabotage are really just a tiny, tiny percentage of those citizens engaged in environmental protection and environmental activism, they not only tried to make it national news that they had finally caught the first domestic terrorists in the country, but they also tried to equate basically a civil disobedience tactic, property damage, as the equivalent of a terrorist act or the equivalent of an act that killed humans. And one of the ways in which the government did that was, you know, number one, we had the defiled Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez hold a press conference where he labeled individuals that were innocent until proven guilty as eco-terrorists, and continue to use that word and that phrase to their benefit. But in addition, that Department of Justice, who, you know, has now been outed as a corrupt, politically pandering group of individuals, also whipped out a little used tool in the legal books called the terrorist enhancement. And this is a sentencing enhancement. It's not a separate crime. None of the individuals involved in the Green Scare were ever actually charged with terrorism. They were charged with arson or conspiracy or property damage. But by using this enhancement, they were able to increase the type and the potential duration of prison sentences, and they were also finally able to try to label these individuals with that terrorist word. Now, the terrorist enhancement has never in the history of the United States been used on defendants who were simply charged with property crimes. Normally, this enhancement was only used on individuals that killed other human beings, like the SS Cole or other situations where most people would look at that and say, yep, that's a terrorist act, you know, blowing up warships, trying to poison drinking water systems. Those, I think, are acts that most people would view as, you know, potentially terrorism. But because of the Bush administration's attempt to expand those definitions, now they literally will encompass nonviolent civil disobedience and other First Amendment type activities. In this case, in the Oregon cases, individuals were the first to face this enhancement. And the government sought the terrorist enhancement against 22 separate actions. And ultimately, the judge ruled that only 4 of those actions did she see as fitting within the terrorist enhancement. And I think that's important because it really demonstrates how much the government was overreaching in order to try and literally draw everything within its net to call it terrorism. And the biggest reason they were doing this, of course, is for political points. They had been unable to catch any quote-unquote real terrorists. You know, Osama bin Laden is still at large. The people who were responsible for 9/11, you know, basically went uncaptured. And so the Bush administration and the Republicans were really losing a lot of clout. And so by calling these activists terrorists, they were able to go back to Congress and say, oh, look, we caught 12 terrorists. We've made the country more safe, and by the way, give us another, you know, $15 million so we can continue this war on environmentalists, in essence. And since then, we've seen, you know, other laws being attempted in the legislatures, and we've seen more and more of these types of cases. The most recent attempt by the government were some indictments that were just issued in Wisconsin, in the Western District of Wisconsin, regarding an action that happened, again, back in 2000. You know, I think it's important to note that all of the crimes that we're talking about that have been caught in this net of Green Scare occurred between 1997 and 2001. These crimes had basically stopped on their own, and the only way the government was able to actually prosecute them was by turning individuals into FBI informants and having them snitch on their co-defendants. And so this action from July of 2000 was at the USFS, you know, the Forest Service Biotechnology Laboratory in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. And basically the accusation is that individuals girdled some trees. And what that means is they went into a genetically engineered tree plantation and took some bark off of the trees so that they would no longer grow and eventually would die. And as a result of this tree girdling, these people, there were 3 individuals that were indicted, Aaron Ellringer, Catherine Christensen, and Brian Rivera. All of them were basically charged with damaging over $1,000 in government property and conspiracy. Normally, these types of cases would have been prosecuted in state courts. You know, the people would have probably gotten 30 days of jail and some fines. But because the government is trying to make a mountain out of a molehill, they are using the federal courts and the FBI and Homeland Security in order to prosecute these people and to make it seem like the ELF or the ALF is a much larger threat to the country than it actually is.
The Earth Liberation Front?
Earth Liberation Front and Animal Liberation Front. One of the individuals that was convicted was basically convicted of sending black faxes to corporations that did business with this animal torture facility. And a black fax basically just means you send a fax to a corporation so that it uses up the toner in the fax machine. And that is, in essence, what this person was convicted of. And that person, along with Daniel McGowan, who is one of the Oregon Green Scare defendants, have now been shipped off by the feds to a supermax facility, prison facility in Marion, Illinois. It's known as Bombers Row. And it is a unit called a communications management unit. And they've sent these 2 young men to this facility in an attempt to further silence them. Both Andy Stepanian, the Shack 7 defendant, and Daniel McGowan were both very outspoken and prolific with writing and publishing things about their cases and about the movements that they were a part of. And the government didn't like that. And when scaring them with federal prison time didn't silence them, they became frustrated. And they have now sent these young men to Bombers Row. Normally, this facility is relegated to those individuals who kill or injure fellow prisoners. They're known as the most violent offenders. And currently, there are only 4 Caucasian individuals in the entire facility. The vast majority of individuals in these facilities are Muslim. And there are 2 reasons why the government has sent these men to this facility, in my opinion. Maybe 3 reasons. The first is, once again, they're trying to bolster this public perception that these individuals are terrorists just like any other. And this, of course, is laughable, particularly when you look at the facts on the face of them. I mean, Andy Stepanian, again, charged with sending a fax to a corporation, and he is somehow going to be perceived as the equivalent of someone who flew a plane into a building and killed humans. And Daniel McGowan was involved in burning genetically engineered crops and without any injuries to any humans at all. And he's going to be, you know, they're going to try to perceive him as the equivalent of an Osama bin Laden, which is absolutely laughable. But that's one of their primary purposes. They think by sending these men to this type of facility that people will think, oh, well, they must have done something to deserve it. And it's outrageous. The second reason, I believe, is because the federal government has been getting a lot of heat for having a facility that was entirely dominated by Muslim individuals. Their racism and, you know, the obvious effects of that racism were starting to draw attention. And so they decided if they throw a couple white guys into this, they can at least say, oh, look, see, it's not all Muslims. We're not, don't look over here. You know, we're not doing anything wrong. And then, of course, the third reason, I believe, is to scare the ever-loving crap out of these 2 young men and to potentially put their lives in danger. They are in an extremely segregated situation. They have virtually 15 minutes a week on the phone to their family members with a government agent listening in to every word. They're only allowed very, very minimal visits with their family through glass and on video, and their communications are being intensely monitored while they basically live in a segregation situation in prison. Now, for Andy Stepanian, his release date is coming up soon, and we're relieved that he will probably not spend too much longer in this type of facility. However, because of the short duration of the remainder of his sentence, he is not going to be able to challenge this unjust and repulsive transfer that was made of him, which, of course, can set precedent for other activists who end up in jail to be sent to similar types of facilities. Daniel McGowan, however, has about 6 years left in his sentence, and he will be challenging this transfer by the federal government. Based on his offense and based on the number of points that he has within prison, he should be eligible for a very low security camp situation. But because the feds are playing kind of a double standard game right now with these individuals and really trying to repress those that may support them, you know, he's been sent off to this maximum security facility, and you know, it's a dangerous place. He's in there with extremely violent individuals, and this is a man who has never harmed a hair on any living thing, but he is a very strong individual, and he has good support, and he has good lawyers working to fight the situation, and people should stay in tune with that situation and look for follow-ups in the future. At this time, we don't even know. The feds have not even provided McGowan with the stated reason why they have transferred him from his low-security prison where he was to this supermax facility. So there is still a lot of information that needs to be uncovered.
Thank you very much. Again, I've been speaking with Lauren Regan, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for covering the story.
Eric McDavid was arrested in Auburn, California on January 13, 2006, as part of the government's ongoing Green Scare campaign. He was convicted of conspiracy to destroy property by means of fire or explosives, despite no crime actually taking place. According to his supporters, Eric's trial was riddled with lies and blunders on the part of the government, who eventually sentenced Eric to 19 and a half years in prison. Eric was held for over 2 years in solitary confinement at the Sacramento County Main Jail since the day of his arrest. There, he struggled with obtaining proper food and had numerous health issues. Eric was arrested along with Zachary Jensen and Lauren Weiner. The government's case was based on the word of a single 18-year-old FBI informant who was paid over $75,000 to fabricate a crime and implicate the trio. Both of Eric's co-defendants caved under the threat of being imprisoned for 20 years and pled guilty to a lesser charge. In doing so, they also agreed to testify against Eric and cooperate in every way possible, including testifying in front of secret grand jury proceedings. We're joined now by the lawyer for Eric McDavid, Mark Reichel. Can you talk about the use of the informant? And how was this informant recruited, and how was she used by the FBI?
Sure. Well, it's a terrible story, and it saddens me to be an American to hear this story of what happened in this case, because this is undisputed by the government. They don't even dispute this. They disagree with me on the significance of it. But as far as the facts, they don't disagree with me on what I'm going to tell you. There was this young gal, she's about 18 or so, and she's in Miami, and she agrees in late 03, I think it is, to go undercover for the Miami Police Department and the Miami FBI and infiltrate political action groups, specifically those that were protesting the Free Trade of the Americas convention, where world leaders were meeting in Miami. Well, there was going to be protesters who are against this based on human rights and social justice issues and legal, lawful protests that make us America. And she infiltrated them for the police department and for the FBI, dressed as, you know, she would have tattoos and a bandana on, and she would call herself a green anarchist and so forth. And she reported to them on the, you know, what was going on there. And she liked it. They liked her. It worked out great. She was way too young to be doing this. But nevertheless, they agreed to use her. And what's interesting is in August of 04, she went out to the Republican National Convention in New York and the Democratic National Convention in Boston. And at both of those conventions, Americans got involved in lawful political protests. There was a war going on, and they weren't happy about it, and not just the war, but they could be unhappy about other political causes and so forth. And the freedom of association, which we all hold dear, is also implicated. So she goes undercover, and she's wearing this same gear, and she is reporting live time on her cell phone the names and the comments attributed to individuals in the groups that are protesting at the Democratic National Convention. You know, when she'd go into groups that are having lawful protests, like law enforcement made them stay a block away from the convention site and sit behind barricades. And she's reporting to what the people are saying and doing to the FBI, who's collecting a dossier of this. She does this then at the Republican National Convention in New York and does the same exact thing. Well, we all think that's repugnant. So shortly thereafter, several senators, including Barack Obama, actually, and others, and congresspersons held hearings in Congress where they called the head of the Justice Department and the head of the FBI in and said, hey, we're made to understand that there were informants at these informants for the FBI at these conventions. And they answered under oath, under penalty of perjury, that's not true. That absolutely is not true. Number one, they said, it just didn't happen. We've done an investigation, and we had no informants doing that. Number two, folks, they said to the Congress and the Senate, that violates our own internal guidelines. Here they are in our books, and our guidelines don't allow for that. Number three, it actually violates other laws that we have, preventing the FBI from domestic surveillance and so forth. And so it didn't happen, and it can't happen under the law. So, you know, that happened, and my case didn't come around until Eric McDavid was arrested in January of 2006. But in our trial, which took place in September of 07, the FBI agent in this case, Anna, which was an assumed name, she testified that she did that, that she was doing exactly that. The discovery, which are the police reports and the FBI reports, which I got in connection with the criminal case, of course, after McDavid was arrested, after January of 06 and prior to the trial in September of 07, I got all this information. The government agreed that she had done all this political spying. They just shrugged their shoulders and said, so what? Who cares? My problem was that I had congressional transcripts from congressional testimony where the Attorney General's office said this doesn't happen. So that is not disputed by the United States Attorney's Office, and that's all in the public record in the McDavid trial. I know it may not have much to do with the guilt or innocence of Eric McDavid, but I just wanted to point that out at the beginning, that that's in the record there. And so the McDavid case is about her being hooked up with the FBI and trying to make a what's called an ELF or ELF or an ALF, ALF case. ELF is the big deal for the Department of Justice. The Earth Liberation Front and the Animal Liberation Front, they believe are the number one domestic terrorist organizations above that of Al-Qaeda. And the Justice Department believes that they're the number one domestic terrorism organization, despite the fact, by their own admission, that there's never been one person harmed or anyone harmed in any way from any of their actions. It's only been property damage.
From what I've read of the case, it seems like this is relevant to your client's guilt or innocence. It seems to me that what happened is an entrapment, as you mentioned earlier. And I wonder if you could just briefly go into that. Was Eric led into this by
yes.
being in love with this informant?
Yes. He met her in August of 04 in Des Moines, Iowa, and she was undercover as an activist, and he fell in love with her. She reported back to the FBI, Eric McDavid is not a person of concern. Eric McDavid is not someone we should be interested in. Eric McDavid is no threat, and he's certainly not a bad guy. So they kept records of that, which was great. After they met, he fell in love with her, and he wrote her love letters, several of them. She testified that that is true. The only reason she testified that that is true is because she was on a tape later talking to one of the co-defendants during this conspiracy when they were wired up, where she said, I heard Eric was writing you love letters. And Anna said, yes, he was. He was writing me love letters. So the love letters were thrown away, though. So Anna threw those away, which is interesting because I don't know that many informants or cops, when they get written statements from future defendants, that they throw them away. But you can imagine why she threw them away. Nevertheless, so McDavid falls in love with her through the winter of 04, tells people, I think I found the one. She contacts him in April of 05 and says, hey, come on out to Philadelphia. We've got to get going. Where have you been? You're absent from the cause. He shows up in Philadelphia in the late spring of 05, and there's and she says, boy, you sure seem to have changed. What's the change in you? And he says, you're the one that changed me.
So by portraying herself as a radical, she helped radicalize him.
Well, yeah. I mean, radicalized him to do what? I mean, I would say that so at that point he's radicalized to maybe spray paint on a billboard. That's direct action. Direct action, you can go protest and stand and refuse to move in front of the Capitol. That's direct action. So McDavid shows up in Philly and that area on the East Coast in the late spring of 05, hopelessly in love with Anna, and she says, I'm looking for real players. I like to hang around real players and so forth and so on. At that point, they meet up with Zach Jensen and Lauren Wiener, and they agree to reassemble on the West Coast in the fall of 05 and get together and hang out and do direct action. And they then separate, and these are three tumbleweeds. McDavid is homeless and penniless. He's a vagabond. He hitchhikes, and when he doesn't hitchhike, he hops freights. He exists out of dumpsters. He's a freegan. He eats what others throw away. And Jensen smokes marijuana all day and is an amoeba. He's incapable of having any inertia. And Wiener goes back to New York, where she's from, and realizes she's not going out to the West Coast because she does not fly. She's deathly afraid of flying. She doesn't want to fly. She has no money. These are young kids who don't even have jobs, and their parents aren't giving them money.
So what did Anna want them to go to the West Coast for?
Direct action.
That wasn't specified what it would be?
Correct.
So how did these three people who, as you indicate, weren't very interested or able to cross the country, how did they go across the country and end up in a cabin with Anna?
This is undisputed by the government, what I'm going to tell you. Again, they just disagree with me on what the significance of the facts are. They think it doesn't show entrapment. I think it does. Anna is constantly calling and badgering Wiener. There are emails and phone calls recorded because she recorded them assuming Wiener would say incriminating things. The FBI thought this was a elf cell, and they finally had one and could prosecute one. So they're tape recording everything. Thank God for posterity, they did. So she's calling Wiener, who says, I'm not flying. She's crying and says, I'm scared to death to fly. I'll do anything for you, Anna. I'll do anything, but I'm scared to death to fly. It's too traumatic for me. Besides, I don't have any money. Well, emails and phone calls from Anna, never from them, but from Anna to McDavid and Jensen and to Wiener, keeps complaining about the three of them. My God, they're not going to do anything. They're all just so lazy, and they have no plans, and they don't want to do anything. And she says, I'll pay for everything. I'll get everybody together. So she does. She purchases, well, the FBI does, purchases the flight for Wiener from New York to Sacramento. And Wiener takes the flight, and she flies out. And it's traumatic for her, and she cries the whole time. And Anna picks her up at the airport in a rental car, and she always has money and everything. And she has a story for why. She says she has money and resources. So she says, okay, let's get together. And so they meet in the fall, and they smoke a bunch of marijuana, and the FBI is listening in with video cameras. They say, yeah, let's do, we got to do a campaign, like a bombing campaign or whatever. And it's her words, not theirs. But they don't even have a set goal on what they're going to do. They talk about doing a bunch of different things. And I mean a bunch of different things. And they have no idea how or, you know, in what manner. But they agree that they'll split for the holidays and get back together right after the first of the year. So they all go home for the holidays. Well, right afterwards, Anna drives to New York and picks up Wiener in New York in her vehicle because Wiener refuses to fly out again. And Anna drives her and Jensen back to California where she's rented a cabin. McDavid comes in. They pick him up. They take him to the cabin. And up in the cabin around January 6th, I think, or so, of 06, they're in this cabin that's wired up. No warrant was sought out for this cabin, for the recording devices either. The FBI just put them in there. They've unpacked their stuff. They're going to live there for a couple of months. And then they decide to try to make plastic explosives. This is all with a recipe that Anna has provided. She's provided the books, the idea. She's provided the chemicals. She's provided everything. They agree to make a hand, the palm of your hand, the size of the palm of your hand, a test explosive, plastic explosive. And they're going to go out in the country and test it to see if it works. So then they buy the product for it, which is bleach and so forth. Unbeknownst to them, the FBI has removed from this recipe anything that will cause this to be plastic explosives. But what it does do is it causes the beaker to melt as they're heating it up over the open flame outside in the backyard. While this is going, Wiener is freaked out inside and says, I don't want to come out, I don't want to come out. And this is all on videotape, and Anna is berating her and cajoling her to come on outside, be part of this group. Everybody has to agree on these things because she's following a script from the FBI, which has, I believe, 25 officers with planes and helicopters around. They've spent your tax dollars like you cannot believe on this giant terrorism case for over a year of an elf cell. And even though they all agree on tape, they say, anything we do, should we do it in the name of Elf Alf? And they all agree, I don't know. Do you think we should? I don't know. And I think two of them say, I don't think we should. Another one says, I don't know. Maybe we should. Maybe we shouldn't. I don't know. That's what they say. If that's an Elf Alf cell, boy, we're spending a lot of money after a cell that doesn't have much to worry us about. But nevertheless, they then, the first cook on this little hand size, palm size of your hand, plastic explosives, doesn't work. So they go back inside, smoke some pot, and Anna freaks out and yells at them and arranges them on the couch because there's a camera in the TV looking at them and they don't know it. And says, we got to talk about what we each want to do in this. And they all have reservation about doing anything significant, and Anna explodes at them and gets mad at them and says, you know, you've got to, how come we don't stick to a plan? You guys are so lazy. You're never going to do anything. I'm with a bunch of people that are never going to do anything. And they say, we don't know what we're going to do, and we don't know what the timeline is going to be. So so the next morning they wake up, and she gives them money and takes them to the store. They go in to buy more bleach. They come out, and they are arrested.
Just back to Anna for a moment.
Sure.
What type of training and background did she have?
Free to do whatever she wanted, freelance. No training whatsoever. Do whatever she wanted. She thought she was like in a movie script in her mind. She had no training on what's entrapment, what's not entrapment, things to stay away from. And they like that because then if she does something, the FBI can say, oh, well, we didn't tell her to do that. If she committed a crime, you know, oh, we didn't tell her to do that.
So it seems from all of the accounts that I've read that this Anna got these young people into her trust, and being a young person herself, then cajoled them, enticed them into being a part of this plot.
Yeah.
How can the government make the case that this is not entrapment?
They don't care. They want a conviction. They did it legally by saying that McDavid was predisposed at the time that Anna first contacted him, that he was predisposed to do this. And they said that she first contacted him in July of 2005, and that all of her contacts before July of 2005 are irrelevant because he wasn't predisposed at the time. So I don't know what to say other than how that logic flies. It flew in the courtroom. And the jury was misinstructed, and the jury, afterwards we got, I think, three declarations from jurors that said they're really sorry that they screwed this up, and they wouldn't have convicted him had they known what the law was, and they felt that they were misled by the court and everything.
And what were those jury instructions?
At number one, you don't look at McDavid's predisposition when he first met the government agent. You look at his predisposition after he had agreed to commit the crime. And that's the opposite of the definition of predisposition. Secondly, they had a question and said, number one, was Anna a government agent in August of 2004? If not, when did she become one? The jury, here's how the procedure works. The jury will send out a question to the court, and the judge will call the lawyers over, and the lawyers come in the courtroom, and the judge is on the bench, and he says, here's the question we have. How do you folks think we should proceed? And often we'll agree, and both of us will say, Your Honor, we think you should tell the jury this or that. Sometimes we will not agree, and the judge will have to make a decision. The government will say, we think you should tell them this. And I'll say, no, you should tell them this, and the law requires this. And the judge will say, okay, I'm going to instruct them as follows. Well, that happened. And in that case, they said, was Anna a government agent in August of 2004? Question mark. If not, when did she become one? Question mark. Well, the government agreed she was an agent in August of 2004, and the judge said, yes, she was. Well, for whatever reason, which we'll never know, what was given back to them was the answer, no. The jury went in there and said, well, they were deliberating. They thought, well, we've been deliberating entrapment, like Mr. Reichel asked us for the last 2 days, and now it says she's not even a government agent in writing from the judge on this slip. Well, we don't have to deliberate entrapment anymore. So we find him guilty. And they were crying and unhappy and upset, and they were very unhappy with their verdict, and they were openly crying. And then they came out and told us he was guilty, and we went out in the hallway, and nine of them stopped and told us why. And when they told us, well, you know, we got the letter that said that the instruction from the court that she was not a government agent. And we said, what? And then we didn't even know about that until we looked and saw that that's what had happened. So,
how could the government say that she wasn't an agent?
They agreed she was an agent in the courtroom.
But that contradicts what was said in court.
Yeah, on the record. Everybody agreed. It could have been a typo. I mean, I don't know. I wasn't there. But when I left, I assumed that what was going to go into the jury room was what we had all agreed, that she was a government agent. Because the government conceded that she was. They said, yes, she was. But he still wasn't entrapped, they argued, because he wanted to do this crime. So that was their argument. She was an agent, but he wanted to do this crime.
And the sentencing of Eric McDavid,
uh-huh.
He has been sentenced to over 19 and a half years for considering property destruction.
Yes, and it's very interesting because they consider it to be domestic terrorism, and I'll just explain to you. If I own a building and I want to burn it for the insurance proceeds, and I insure it at $5 million and I know that I have to rebuild, I can keep some money, and I burn it down and I get my $5 million and they catch me, I think I'd get about 6 years in federal prison because that's basically what the guidelines call for. But if I went to a McDonald's and no one was around and it was 2 a.m. and it was long closed in the middle of nowhere on some country road, and I hate McDonald's because they chop down trees in the Amazon and they have too much cattle and so forth, and I want to send a political message to McDonald's, so I take a paper bag And inside of it, I put a beer can, and I dump out the beer, and I put a little bit of gasoline in there, and I put a wick on it. And I'm fully aware that when I light it, it's going to burn the bag and the gasoline, and I set it right next to the bathroom door on McDonald's. And I know that when it's done, it's going to char that door about 2 feet high, maybe 18 inches high, and put a black shadow on the McDonald's door, which probably could be washed off at some point, but it's going to be hard. They'd probably have to repaint it. And I spray paint above it, ELF, stop, you know, destroying our environment. And I go back in my car and I light it and I watch it. And I think, great, it says ELF on the door and there's a little burn mark there. That'll scare McDonald's and make my political statement. And I go home. And then I turn myself into the police the next day. I have committed a crime of domestic terrorism. And as a result, because of my political views, I will face about 20 years in federal prison.
This is because of the terrorism enhancement.
Yes, exactly.
And how was that used in Eric's case?
It elevated his case from an 8-year conviction for attempted arson or conspiracy to commit arson to conspiracy to destroy government property as pursuant to a scheme of domestic terrorism. Because she got them on the tapes to say, "You're not happy with a political, you know, should we do direct action to make a political voice, to make a political statement?" Yes, we should.
But direct action could mean anything.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, spray painting a billboard is illegal, and it's direct action. And if it is done with a political purpose, you know, it's arguably, you know, domestic terrorism. Unfortunately, vandalism like that, the statute has like 1 year on it, so you get 1 year if you did that for political reasons. But arson had that arson statute goes to 20 years maximum. And the domestic terrorism enhancement takes you to the statutory maximum.
And mm-hmm. So now you're going to appeal.
Yes, ma'am.
And what are the grounds for appeal?
Various, probably 15 different grounds. Specifically, what I've identified in our conversation today, one, what went into the jury room was wrong. Additionally, even forget what went in the jury room, the prior instructions to them were wrong. And then as well, we had a host of pretrial motions which were denied, and those should have been granted, and they would have resulted in a different trial. They would have been resulted in the throwing out of evidence and so forth. We had argued that the whole case should have been thrown out before trial. We had argued that since there was no warrant, that the government can't put a house for you to live in and record every one of your intimate moments in your house and not get a warrant from a judge. The Fourth Amendment requires them to get a warrant, and we believe we're going to win that one.
Do you think the Patriot Act had some part to play in that?
Yes, all sorts. Absolutely. Every chance they wanted. I mean, everything they did was because of the loosening of restrictions under the Patriot Act. Yes. By the minute, we are losing our civil liberties in this country. Yes, absolutely.
Do you think that your client was targeted for his ideology and for his beliefs?
Oh, absolutely. She was told to find. She said that's who she was looking for. She was looking for young males who identify themselves as green anarchists.
And then lure them into a trap.
Uh-huh. To be prosecuted.
And what do you think are the implications?
It's not a good road to go down. But I think it's been going on forever in this country. I mean, you know, society goes on quite often. I mean, you know, it's nothing different than COINTELPRO and McCarthy era and in the 60s. And, you know, I mean, it's common. I mean,
Well, thank you very much. Again, I've been speaking with Mark Reichel, the attorney for Eric McDavid. And if people want to support Eric, do you know if there's a good way for them to do that?
Yeah. They can check on there's a website put out by his family and his supporters called supporteric.org.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Mark Reichel, for speaking with us.
Well, thank you very much for everything you do.
Lord have mercy on my soul.
Eileen McDavid is the mother of Eric McDavid, who is currently serving a sentence of 19 and a half years for so-called eco-terrorism. And so I wanted to ask you, Eileen McDavid, a little bit about Eric.
Eric McDavid, he is somebody that you definitely wouldn't think was an eco-terrorist. he is a very kind and loving person. He would never hurt people. He would never hurt animals. he, you know, loved his family. We were a very close family. And even though the government tried to make that the opposite of that, like he was trying to be away from home and wasn't connected, that's not true at all. He was always connected with us when he'd travel. And so it just, he's the opposite of what they tried to make people see that he was. He was a very warm person. Even through all of this, he's maintained very level-headed and loving point of view. So I'm, you know, I have always been really close with him, and this was really hard to go through and watch him go through. But, you know, he's doing it.
And how is Eric doing now? Are you able to visit him?
Yes, we visit him once a month now since he's quite a ways away. He's about 9 hours drive away, so we take airplane. So we're doing it once a month. We were seeing him when he was in the jail every week, twice a week for the first year. But, yeah, just once a month.
And what are those visits like? Is he having a hard time? Is he able to get the support that he needs?
Yeah, he has visitors almost every weekend. We work it out that way. So, you know, his sister goes and her husband go down and visit him one weekend, and we go down another weekend, and then some friends have gone down. And also, his partner goes down as often as she can, sometimes once a week if she can get down there on the bus or whatever, and his sister's going with us this weekend. So, you know, we really try and get somebody down there to visit with him, yeah.
Is he being held in a federal prison?
Yes, he is, uh-huh.
And what is that facility like?
Well, oddly enough, it's so much improved over the county jail that he was in Sacramento. And they're actually much more friendlier. And that was a really bizarre thing for me to get over. You know, I thought it would be worse. I thought it would be really hard to imagine him there. But, in fact, it's, you know, he's at medium security, which is, you know, much more better than the other security, the higher security, of course. But, you know, it was just they're much more aware of him as a human being, where at the county jail, I don't know if, you know, Mark told you, but, you know, he had health issues that weren't tended to. His food was not tended to. He's vegan. So he just wasn't given, you know, treated like a human being, we felt there. And he wasn't even proven guilty at that point. So it was really bizarre. And to think that now that he's, you know, gone through the case, not that we think he's guilty, but that he went through the trial, they're treating him better. So I don't get that part.
And have you followed any of the other people convicted in the Green Scare? I understand that two Green Scare defendants have just been transferred to a notorious facility in Illinois. Do you have any fear that something like that might happen to Eric?
Actually, you know, we are afraid of that, you know, that he might be transferred across the country or something. So, yeah, I mean, there's a fear that we won't be able to get to him as easily, but we would still try.
And you mentioned that Eric is a vegan and someone who has not harmed anyone, would never harm anyone. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what types of activities he was involved in before all this happened.
Yeah, Well, before this, when he was going to school, he was very much interested, got interested in the peace movement. You know, he joined a couple groups, one up in Nevada City and one in Sacramento, and I think he even went over to San Francisco and participated in peace groups when the war was imminent and, you know, there was peace actions going on there. And he went and got some training as a peacekeeper or, you know, with to deflate the any kind of violence that might happen between, you know, like the policemen and the peace marchers. And so, you know, he was active in those kind of groups and really was interested in, you know, bringing peace. And
so in getting involved in social justice work, has he impacted his family in any of that?
Oh, sure. Gosh, we've changed so much. I mean, you know, he's really helped us see beyond our bubble. And it was hard to get us there because, you know, we just wanted to hide our heads like a lot of people do because of the fear factor. But, of course, you know, since he's been arrested, that's awakened us hugely. But even before that, he, you know, just we would sit and talk for hours about the world situation. And, you know, he would bring up some really good points. You know, he's a philosopher major, and so he was, you know, had that aspect to bring in there too, and questioning himself and all of that. So, yeah, we've really changed. He woke us up to watch Democracy Now, which we're very appreciative of it because that's about the only clear picture of the world you're going to get, that and independent media. So we hardly watch the other. I mean, yeah, huge impacts with us. And, you know, we try to tell as many people as possible, and they aren't even aware of it. So he's brought, you know, he's awakened us, we feel like, you know, as a family. And you know, we're much more aware than we were before.
And I've seen that he plays the guitar. Has he been able to do that in his new facility?
Actually, yes. I mean, I was really surprised to hear that they would let him do that.
Do you think that your son's case is indicative of a lessening of democracy in this country?
Oh, definitely. That is a definite yes. I mean, just the idea of planting informants in peace groups and amongst people, young people, you know, like himself, and one count of conspiracy. I mean, to me, that says, okay, you have to go to jail if you're thinking or talking a certain way. I mean, just that little piece of it. And, you know, here she was pushing them along into that hole, you know, of being bad. So it took away from them being individuals and having their own opinions and their wants for the future without getting arrested. I mean, yeah, that totally takes away any sort of rights, you know, and even saying that it's democratic is questionable, definitely, yes.
So I don't want to get too much into the case, but do you think that the young woman informant, Anna, led your son into a trap?
Yes, I do.
Do you think that what she did is legal?
I think they think it's legal, but I don't, as far as the Constitution goes, I wouldn't think it was legal. I think it's illegal to push somebody into, quote-unquote, doing a crime.
Although they didn't actually carry any action out, which
no,
makes this case
didn't.
Really unusual that they were just convicted of a conspiracy.
Yes, one count of conspiracy.
So what can people do to help if they're interested in supporting Eric How can they find out more information?
Well, they can go to supporteric.org, and there's ways on there that have been listed that they can help. They can send money, you know, to help for visits, to travel down to visit. I know his partner could, you know, use that money for that. Or for books, send books. I know he has a list of books that he'd like. And just simply pass on the word of what's happening. I think a lot of people are not aware of what is going on, you know, and especially with our young people right now. I mean, with the RNC, it was done again, you know, people arrested and informants planted and all of that. So get the word out so we can try to stop this illegal act by the government. Be aware. Step out of the bubble.
And how do you feel towards the informant who ended up putting your son in prison for this long sentence?
Well, I can't help but see it as, you know, something put her in that position to agree to do such a thing, you know, to go against other young people her age. And I don't quite understand how another human can do that kind of work and look in the mirror every day and feel good about what they did and feel good about themselves. I don't have hatred or anything. It's more sadness for her that, you know, she didn't see what she was doing to Eric, to his family, his partner, the people around him. I don't get that part, you know, that I don't understand how people can do those kind of things and go through every day after that. Yeah, it's up to them to deal with, though, that's for sure.
Thank you for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Eileen McDavid, the mother of Eric McDavid.
You can say that it's about the savages. You can say you have a better way to live. You can call it manifest destiny. You can talk of all your civilization will give. You can say that we're a thing of history, and progress is the future you will bring. You can send your armies to these mountains. You can say we'll prosper beneath your king. But there will always be resistance. The next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose. Because our future is not yours to choose.
You've been listening to a special on the Green Scare, the federal crackdown on environmental direct action activists that began in 2005, with surveillance and informants dating back years before that. This special was produced by Jenka Soderberg for KBOO's September 11th special on the War on Liberty. Music by DJ Coldcut, Poor Righteous Teachers, Dub Tribe, David Rovix, and Dead Prez.
Yourself a Democrat. You can call yourself whatever you will. You can keep on stamping out the fires you start, so you might stay on top of the hill. But there will always be resistance. The next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose. Because our future is not yours.